Hi, Real Crime Profilers. It's Laura here, jumping in ahead of the podcast we recorded with Mike Boudet from Sword and Scale about male sexual victimisation. This is a really important topic, with brave victims coming forward and those who are interviewed on episode 99 of Sword and Scale. So if you haven't listened to it, we'd recommend listening to it before this next podcast. But in light of the current context and what's happening present day, I wanted to acknowledge the brave victims coming forward, sharing their stories of abuse by Harvey Weinstein and the impact that it's had on so many. The words Me Too are trending on social media after women were asked to share if they had ever been sexually assaulted or harassed. American actor Alyssa Milano and Rose McGowan shared a screenshot of the suggestion and asked people to reply with the words Me Too to show the magnitude of the problem. Well, more than 30,000 women replied by Monday morning, and thousands more posted on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. This really underlines my point that I make in this podcast. We never truly know the full scale of abuse or the prevalence. And I thought long and hard before I posted the words Me Too on my profiles, as I'm sure many others will have. In fact, I believe through my own personal and professional experience, you'd be hard pushed to find a woman who's not been sexually assaulted or harassed. Sadly, it's something that we've had to put up with, to tolerate and deal with, as it happens oftentimes in spaces where we should feel the safest. It happens in our homes, our schools and our workplaces. And sadly, when we do speak up, we're rarely believed or listened to. Questions are asked of us, what we did, what we said, what we were wearing. And there's no accountability for the perpetrators who move on to other victims, destroying more lives. I really hope this creates a much needed cultural shift of asking questions of the perpetrator, the person who the blame, shame and judgment should reside with. We would talk about Harvey Weinstein, the victims and the Mountain Metropolitan Police Service investigation into at least five sexual assault allegations in the UK in a separate podcast and give you our analysis and our thoughts on it. And so I'm going to end with a call to action before we deep dive into the pod and ask you to sign our petition for serial perpetrators, serial stalkers and domestic violence offenders to be included on the Violent and Sexual Offenders Register and managed by the multi-agency public protection arrangements, which will firmly place the focus on the perpetrator, which is exactly where it should be. And now to this important podcast. Thank you for listening and for your support, and please continue to review us and share us with others.
Because we didn't talk about that kind of stuff, and I had no idea that boys could be victimized. So, long story short, I just basically held it to myself. When we started school again, I went to our guidance counselor, who was a priest, and I told him, and he told me, say 10 Our Fathers and 10 Hail Marys and never speak of this again. I absolve you of your sins. So that just added to my guilt, if anything. Years later, as an FBI agent, I'd be the one to investigate that very priest. And the Catholic Archdiocese of New York is just now, 40 years later, paying money to the victims who that priest had victimized in my high school.
I was now on the grass, just feet away from the van. As I looked at the picture, I didn't notice the driver's door slowly inching open. I was still focused on the picture, trying to remember if I had seen this kid somewhere before. I didn't notice that the van's door was now almost a quarter of the way open, but something in my peripheral vision snapped me out of my concentration on that picture. It was the man's face. There was something off about it. His expression didn't make sense. And that's when I looked down and noticed that I could see through the crack in the open door. The man wasn't wearing any pants, and he was masturbating. I immediately pulled away and skateboarded home as fast as I could. I told no one. In fact, it took well over a decade for me to finally open up about this incident to anyone.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler, writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today from London is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, and founder and director of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I am Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds, where Jim Clementi is my colleague.
And today we have a very special guest with us.
This is Mike Boudet, creator and host of the true crime podcast Sword and Scale.
Well, we're really happy
to have you on, Mike.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I recently was interviewed by Mike on Sword and Scale for episode number 99. And wow, what an emotional roller coaster that was listening to that episode, Mike. It was really, really well done. Thank you.
Thank you. You know, your story, it was part of a series of stories that we told on the show. There were three major stories, and I sort of jumped in with some of my own anecdotes from my childhood. Mm-hmm. But your story, which was at the very end, was so inspirational to so many of our listeners because you turned a heart-wrenching, horrible situation into something positive. I've gotten so many tweets and so many emails and so many messages from people just saying that you are an inspiration to them. Mm-hmm. So thank you for that.
We should say that this is episode 99 on Sword and Scale, Mike?
That's correct.
And what was the genesis of you doing this particular topic?
Well, a while back, we did an episode on child abuse. And, you know, our audience being predominantly female because we're a true crime show. And I don't know why that is, but for some reason, women really love true crime shows. but, you know, the majority of our listeners are female. And so we got a lot of people writing in and telling us their stories. And so that episode was about three different women with three different stories. And they told their stories about how they were abused as children. And we wanted to do it again because we had such just a overwhelmingly positive response to that episode. But, you know, I wanted to do something a little different. And I thought, it became very obvious to me that this is a subject that no one talks about, the male sexual child abuse. It's really kind of sad just because of the way that our society is. You know, when boys are treated a certain way from very young, if you're a little boy and you fall off your bike and you scrape your knee, they tell you to man up, you know, stop crying. You're supposed to take it. Don't be a sissy. And boys are expected to act a certain way growing up. And, you know, when it's a little girl, everybody kind of runs over and, you know, comforts her and, you know, it's okay to cry. It's okay to express your feelings. It's different for boys. And so you can see how those constraints put on little boys by society have a way of affecting how they behave when they are actually truly victimized. And the perpetrators seem to know this and exploit it. And so I wanted to tell the story from a perspective of boys, of, you know, what it's like to grow up with this horrible thing in your past and how it affects your entire life.
I thought the episode was actually very powerful. I listened to it on the plane just as I was flying back to London, and just the different experiences and the pain, I have to say, that you could just hear in a number of the voices was just so, so emotional. And, you know, of course, I know Jim's story, but I still feel it is incredibly inspirational and uplifting. But just how people live with these secrets and are just made to feel so alone and isolated and guilty. And I think it's certainly, you know, hearing about it from a male perspective. Of course, I hear a lot of female abuse, but hearing it from, you know, a number of different people, including from you, Mike, just being exposed to different things and how that plays into, you know, masculinity and sense of self and keeping secrets, you know, how toxic it can be. It really did move me. And I thought you did an excellent job of crafting together those very emotional experiences. And I've got to pay tribute to everyone who, you know, was so honest about what had happened to them, Jim included. I thought it was incredibly powerful. So thank you for doing it.
Thank you, Laura.
And I think that I'm glad you said that, the way that we talked about it, the openness in which we talked about these very difficult topics is sort of the whole point. You know, I recently saw a very poignant tweet by someone responding to this episode that said that the two things that a survivor needs to hear are, I believe you, and it's not your fault. And a lot of these kids don't, when this happens to them, don't know that and don't feel that and carry that their entire lives, thinking that somehow they did something wrong, thinking that people won't believe them if they speak up. So it's very important to be very open, very clear, and say that this happened to me.
Right. And one other thing I would add that I believe that every survivor needs to hear is that it doesn't have to ruin your life either. One of the problems is that I think especially professionals in the field, whether they're law enforcement or psychological professionals or other kinds of professionals in fields related to child sexual victimization, they typically speak about it in very graphically negative terms. In other words, it destroyed my child's life, this child will be ruined forever, and so on and so forth. And, you know, not only do kids all over the world hear these statements, but, you know, survivors hear it, and kids who have recently been victimized or in the process of being victimized hear it. And what they then think is, well, this means that my life is over, and they can be very fatalistic at that point. And I think we need to also always infuse hope and compassion and resources into our statements about it. And because of that, I would like Lisa is going to tell us some of the resources that are available to people who are out there who are in the midst of being victimized or who have been victimized in the past, because it's really important to know you're not alone. There are many millions, and let me repeat that, millions of us survivors out here, and we are on your side.
Absolutely. And some of these resources I'm getting from our friend Joelle Kostaek's book. She has many books on this topic. You can get them on Amazon, you know, for not very much at all. But here's
The
Well-Armored Child. And the one that I'm reading from, she has one about how to talk to survivors of all kinds of abuse. But anyway, there is an organization called RAIN, R-A-I-N-N, the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, and that's www.rain.org, and it offers 24-hour crisis hotline for any survivor or anybody going for anybody suffering from abuse, and they also have referral and educational services, advocacy. So RAIN is an amazing organization. That's 1-800-656-HOPE, H-O-P-E, and I'll be mentioning others as we go through the episode today. But one thing I wanted to say, Mike, what I so admire about that particular episode, and if our listeners haven't heard that particular episode 99 on Sword and Scale, you know, please, after listening to this, go right over and check it out. But you structured it with three different stories, including some of your own anecdotes from your childhood. You have a story from a guy from Australia. Is he from Australia?
Yes. Yeah.
And his name is Alan. And then you have, it sounds like an American, you have a guy from California, from a small town, California, who calls himself Danny. And then, of course, Jim's story, which I learned, even though I know Jim's story, I learned a lot of really powerful things when he talked to you about it. But my question to you is, how did you curate those stories? Because it sounds like you had a lot of people reaching out to you when you asked your listeners for stories.
Yeah. When I decided that this is a route I wanted to take, I put it out there on our social media, asking for people to reach out and tell us what they'd gone through, and we got quite a few responses, but not anywhere near what the response we got after the episode came out. We've had hundreds of emails and voicemails and comments, and some of them are so powerful. You can hear the anguish, the emotion in their voices. And for some of these people, it's the first time that they've ever repeated this out loud to anyone. And they're calling in and letting us know what happened to them. And it's incredibly powerful.
I think it's also, you know, as Jim said, it's the fact, you know, if people aren't alone and shouldn't feel that they're alone, and keeping that kind of secret and knowing it's okay to talk about it, you know, and there's no right way to deal with it. You know, for some, it is about speaking to a professional or going to the police. And For others, it's really hard to make sense of what's gone on. But talking about it, of course, saying it out loud makes it a reality. And I know from reading some of those emails and certainly some of the posts that, you know, people have kept those secrets for so long, and even using the word sexual abuse feels very alien to them. But, you know, it's important for people to know that there are many people, many mediums, even just writing it out or, you know, calling you up and explaining the narrative of what's gone on. And as Jim said, you can control your narrative. And, you know, Jim turned it around in a formidable way. And I've always been inspired by Jim and his story. And of course, many don't realize how he joined the FBI or why, but has gone on to save many, many young children, many young boys as well, and has become a real hero from that. But that journey is so different for everybody, and I think that's very true when you read all the emails and posts that you've received. So thank you for forwarding some of them, and of course, you know, you can see them also just underneath the episode on Sword and Scale, can't you?
Yeah, and not to harp on this point, but the whole idea that the boys, you know, the stories about boys, and there was that study that we talked about in the episode where 76% of sexual assault victims under the age of 15 are female and only 24% are male. But then when you really look at it, 50 to 60% of the time, females come forward and say that they were abused, whereas males only do it about 30% of the time. So you can imagine how many millions of silent survivors there are out there. Not to minimize anyone's, you know, sure, abuse, whether sure. you're male or female, but there's so many silent male victims out there because of all of these constraints on them, put on them by society, and the fear of being called a liar, the fear of them being called a future perpetrator, the fear of them being called homosexual, the fear that they maybe did something wrong. All of these things kind of play into this keeping them quiet,
right.
and it works in the favor of the perpetrators, unfortunately.
Yeah, that conspiracy of silence. But another thing about that, about the reporting, I mean, there's a number of different studies out there, and they look at those numbers in different ways. I mean, there have been many studies that say that 1 in 4 girls will be victimized by the time they're 18 and 1 in 6 boys. But again, as you mentioned, I think the reporting rates of boys is much lower than that of girls. But of all children, it's very, very low. But there's additional stigma attached to a boy reporting than there is to a girl reporting. On top of that, there are studies that have shown that when they have done, you know, mass volume studies and asked, not specifically on male sexual victimization or female sexual victimization, but they've asked general populations, large populations, and maybe one or two questions in there have to do with whether they were victimized. And in those studies, it's equal numbers that report 25% of the population has been victimized, whether they're male or female. So I think that makes a lot of sense, especially when you look at offending rates, because the offenders who offend against adolescent boys are much more likely, multiple times likely, more likely to have multiple victims in the 200 and 300 victim range. So that's something that you can, you know, when you start looking at those numbers and see that those offenders are much more prolific, you can start to see why there are many, many more boys victimized than who report.
Although I think that's right in terms of there are additional issues regarding stigma. But I also have to say that it's very difficult to know truly, as we all know, with reporting rates and prevalence of abuse, what really is, you know, the true scale. And I have to say, I know many people who have disclosed to me, females in particular, that they were sexually abused and they have never told a soul. Mm-hmm. And in their 40s, 50s, 60s, and they've never talked to anyone about it. So I think we have to be a little bit careful. If you add in cultural issues,
yeah,
of where
that, yeah.
people live and where they come from, You know, there can be so-called honor-based abuse, and therefore young girls and, you know, young boys will never speak out because of the fear of something even worse happening to them if they do. So I think we just have to be a little bit careful around generalizations. But I absolutely take the point that there are further issues that compound for young boys. And, you know, there are also additional issues that compound for girls as well in different ways.
Yeah. And I was going to say that, too, that the girls have to worry about being labeled
whores.
A slut or a whore, whereas
absolutely.
Guys who are victimized don't typically have that worry. They have the different ones about sexuality and so forth. But this is also a great time to bring up the issue of who are the offenders, because, yes, most offenders that we know about in cases that are reported are male, but there are large numbers of females. And I think recently there's much more coverage in the cases in which female teachers have molested their students.
But not enough.
Did you know that very recently, an Alabama judge ordered that Alabama teachers are allowed to have sex with their students as long as the student is above their age of consent, and that it is wrong to tell teachers that it's discriminatory if you tell teachers that they can't have sex with their students if they're 16 or 17 years old in that state where that's the age of consent. It's just unbelievable how this can go backwards like that.
Yeah, Mike, that's why I appreciate your Danny, who's one of the guys who speaks on your episode. I mean, his voice was just heartbreaking to me, his trauma at being molested by a female teacher when he was in junior high, I believe.
Yeah, and that's another thing, too. If the perpetrator's female, there's all of these conflicting feelings and issues that arise. It becomes very not clear-cut anymore how you're supposed to feel about that as a young boy.
Oftentimes, young boys will feel additional shame from being sexually abused in that they feel that they're now sexual. And for a lot of young boys, that adds increased shame and will deter them from coming forward and talking about the abuse.
One of your listeners brought up a book about that very topic, and I won't say the name of it because I don't want to encourage people to buy it, but I did post a review on that Amazon book selling site about the book, because people are saying, oh, it's such an amazing, insightful view into the psychopathic mind of an offender. Well, actually what it is a very graphic sexual novel about a woman who decides to go to become a middle school teacher so she can specifically target 14-year-old boys, sexually abuse them, and leave them. She wants this to haunt them for their whole life. Oh, it is specifically stated in her in this book, in this character that she's built. And it's not just an expose about this kind of thing happening. It is written in a very erotically, sexually graphic manner, and it's particularly meant to turn on the reader. And this is offensive. It should be absolutely outlawed, because what it does is it builds consensus that this is okay. It's going to be the fodder for masturbation for sex offenders, male and female, who are sexually attracted to 14-year-old boys. It is in great detail a sexual novel. It is erotica, it's child erotica, and it is disgusting in my book.
It's like the reverse Lolita. Is that what they're trying to do?
Even much more graphic. Mm-hmm. Much more graphic. All about sex, very little about falling in love. It's not about falling in love, in fact. It's about sexually targeting, grooming, and sexually assaulting and raping boys.
Is that part of the narcissism of these kind of offenders, that they seek out jobs where they can be, I think we've talked about this before, to be closer to kids, so they seek out professions like in the clergy or in education, things like that? I believe you mentioned that before.
I think there are multiple reasons why people seek out those jobs of opportunity where they have access, authority, and control over children. The fact is that many of them do that for the specific purpose of being in a position of authority over children, being able to work out situations where they can be private and alone with children and take advantage of them sexually. This book clearly draws that out, I mean, in great detail. It's actually a how-to novel on how to do this. And it's extremely offensive to me. And it's very offensive that people are just talking about it in its artistic value or writing value, because it was not necessary to go into all the sexual detail. This book was written to sexually arouse people about adults having sex with little boys. And that's an absolute, and it's unfortunate. But many people who are drawn to occupations where they have access and authority to children are doing it for the right reasons. But these offenders deliberately find these jobs because, one, they love being around children of the age that they're targeting. They do not tire of the interactions with children like we do as an adult. But they actually embrace the fact that they'll be able to take advantage of kids if they take these jobs.
Yeah, and Mike, in Danny's story, his abuser's a fucking superintendent now, isn't she? I mean, she's like been rewarded for her service.
Yeah.
In abusing boys.
And
she's still teaching, right? She's still out there.
We had to go back into the episode and delete parts where it becomes clear where this person is from, because we did not want to out this person and expose them. I mean, I'm talking about the victim to letting people know who they are. This is actually goes to a question I wanted to ask you, Jim, because a lot of the response we got in relation to this episode was from a third party, someone that's outside the situation that knows what happened, that knows who the victim is and who the perpetrator is and what happened, and they want to do something. But from my perspective, I think that it's probably wrong to victimize the person yet again by outing them. I think that that's up to the victim to decide how to come forward, when to come forward, and it's okay to encourage them, but it's definitely not okay to out them.
Yeah, I think we do have to be very careful about those kinds of things, because you don't want to create more psychological damage to the victim than has already been inflicted upon them. However, on the other hand, I think it's incredibly important for people listening, people around people who they think have been victimized, and people who are victimized, to understand that there are plenty of services out there. There are people you can talk to. MaleSurvivor.org is an international organization, and it's focused on the sexual victimization of males. And there are message boards where you can talk to other survivors. There are resources available for therapy and for weekends of recovery and things like that. StopItNow.org has a lot of great information out there about how you can identify offenders and grooming techniques and things like that. And SafeForAthletes.org has a lot of best practices and for all youth-serving organizations, and they can adopt these free documents that will help set up organizations' rules and regulations so that children can be safer. So there's a lot of things out there to help people who are victimized. And one of the things that they can do, as I did in my case, is also come forward and talk to law enforcement. Because one of the things that I think you were concerned about, Mike, and I certainly was concerned about when I found out that there were multiple other victims, is helping to stop other kids from being victimized. And I'm not saying that's a responsibility of everybody, but I think that anybody who can help stop that should help stop that. And the way to do that is to actually report them, even if it's much later in the game and there's the statute of limitations has run. Making an official report puts it on paper so that the police agencies that cover that offender can actually, the next time somebody comes in, hopefully within the statute of limitations, they can actually bolster that case against the guy and lock him down.
Mike, can't your listener, without outing the victim, bring law enforcement's attention to this offender? I mean, there's got to be some way for the community at large if it's an open secret or something that needs to be investigated. I mean, isn't that what keeps them able to
keep
offending?
I'm going to weigh in here because this is absolutely a child protection issue and a safeguarding issue. And by law, certainly in the UK, you are duty bound if you believe that other children are at risk, then that overweighs everything else. So we over here would have a duty to report that individual, not in terms of outing the victim, but in terms of if we do believe that there is somebody who could be abusing children in a position of trust, and particularly, you know, working in a school with access to children, then you are duty bound.
I think that's a noble idea, but in sort of practice, if you know that it, by coming forward with something that's happened to you, someone is now bound to report it, then it actually keeps you even more silent, I think, in some cases.
Well, in the UK, Mike, I mean, you are duty bound. It's a safeguarding issue. So it would always be the case, you know, whether it's through, we have Crime Stoppers and various other anonymous platforms. But if you do believe a child's at risk, then, and again, it's not coming back to the person who you spoke to the actual victim, to out them. But if there's a third party who has joined the dots up here and believes that they understand who that individual is at the school, then they can report that. And that individual, as we know, and as Jim knows, will probably have abused multiple people. And it's the tipping point. You know, we've had lots of cases like Jimmy Savile and Rotherham and others where, you know, one person, and it's not always the victim, has come forward, and then others have, it's opened the floodgates to many, many more. And that tipping point can be an important thing. And it's not always from the victim. And sometimes the, you know, the originating victim later on may be grateful for that, but it's their choice whether they then want to come forward, if you see what I mean. But it depends. Each situation is different, but we do have very robust safeguarding procedures in place. And that is something that is, we run national awareness campaigns about it too. So it's not about, you know, the person that you have spoken to specifically, but I think you named a third party, did you say, who knows who it is?
Not in that particular case, but yes, we did get a lot of emails from third parties that were familiar with some sort of abuse happening to someone they know, and that person not wanting to come forward, but them want, you know, the person that's contacting us really does want to get this out there.
Well, the thing that they can do, and so, Laura, the difference between your laws and our laws are that there are specific mandated reporters. And these are typically people who are in professions revolving around youth-serving organizations. Anybody in an authority position in a school or a doctor or a nurse or a therapist, they are mandated reporters. So they have to, under the law, report if they find out any information that says that a child is at risk, or that somebody, even if it's their patient, is going to commit a crime against a child or someone else. They are mandated reporters. However, here there's no obligation on the part of average citizens when they find out about this. That doesn't mean that an average citizen can't step forward and go to any mandated reporter that could be related to this this person, this offender. They could go to a mandated reporter. So they could report even anonymously to any school official, any public official, any doctor or psychologist or anybody in law enforcement. They could do it anonymously and still get the same results. In other words, that mandated reporter will then have to create an investigation either with the Department of Child Welfare or Department of Public Services, depending on the jurisdiction, or in law enforcement.
Right. So we kind of have a similar process as well of having designated safeguarding professionals. So if you know, let's say, you know, John James, there, as Lisa said, community rumors, intelligence about John James, who is in a position of trust, who may have abused child X and possibly child Y, then there is a process where people can report things anonymously or not. and can equally ask about the history of somebody. If a child is believed to have been, we have the child sexual abuse disclosure scheme. If you believe that a particular individual that you know may have abused child X, then you can also ask the police whether there is information or intelligence about that person. So, you know, we have tried to move things to a position where there's sort of two avenues, but it sounds like it's slightly different in the US.
And this would not, and Mike, you know, don't get us wrong, we're not saying that we'd want to encourage, you know, finger pointing and false accusations and that kind of thing, but this is an epidemic. This is an absolute epidemic. It just boggles my mind. And you know, looking at all the letters that you've shared with us and all the letters that we get and people, you know, coming forward one after the other with all of these secrets that they've held for years. And why? Why does this happen? Because there is this atmosphere of shame and secrecy and people around not coming forward. I don't mean the victim. I mean people around who just look the other way. Good people looking the other way, even though they know it's happening. And just like in your other story, your first story with Alan, how, and you talked about it too with your father, there is just an atmosphere of acceptance of this, some kind of bro code of sexuality and abuse. I mean, would you agree that was kind of part of the narrative?
Yeah, and the reason I included some of my anecdotes in there weren't because I want to compare what happened to me as a child as to any of these, you know, much more extreme stories of sexual abuse and child abuse. But I wanted to make it very clear to the audience that this danger is all around us and has been ever since I was a child.
Let me tell you.
Yeah, oh, my God. Are you kidding? The number of people who have jumped out of the bushes and jacked off in front of me or been in the subway and some guy's rubbing. I mean, it happens. Every woman out there has had that guy pull over on the sidewalk and you walk by and he's masturbating or coming up to you. I mean, we just don't talk about
it. Five times.
It happens everywhere. Yep. It happens in every country and every nationality. It's widespread and it's something we need to, as a society, face and not look the other way anymore and talk about. And I'm glad you brought up that book, Jim, in terms of the way that sort of like popular culture and the media and mainstream media seems to now sensationalize this sort of epidemic of women and teachers, female teachers exploiting young boys. And it seems like, I don't know if you've gotten this sense either, but it seems like the more attractive the perpetrator, the more sensationalized the story gets and the more widespread it gets. And then there's like that whole bro code.
Absolutely.
Oh, you know, where were these teachers when I was a boy and that kind of crap, you know?
Absolutely. I have a PowerPoint presentation in which I actually go into female offenders in great detail and sort of track what the numbers are of reported cases, for example, and how they report those cases. And many of them, if you just put in teen sex romp and teacher into Google, you'll find hundreds and hundreds of cases in which they call it a sex romp rather than this teacher was sexually victimizing this child. And it's offensive. But with respect to that book, a director has said that he wants to do the movie version of this book, and it happens to be the same director who did the movie Kids in the 80s, which was about kids getting involved in sex and drugs. Many pedophiles had that movie. Yeah. Many pedophiles masturbated to that movie, and they said it was their favorite movie, and it was deliberate. And if this guy is doing the same thing with this book, I'm telling you, there's no way that's legitimate. Mm-hmm. That's just trying to, you know, be a cautionary tale. But the fact is that, unfortunately, the way society deals with male sexual victimization, especially by female offenders, is an extremely hurtful way. And I've talked to literally hundreds of men who have been suffering for years because they can't form trusting relationships with women because they were taken advantage of. A perfect example, and I'll say his name because he's come out in the news and talked about this, is Chris Brown. Chris Brown said he lost his virginity at age 8. Well, he lost it to somebody who was 16. Now, that's a sex offense. That's rape. That's not losing your virginity. And then when he's 15, the school female school security guard started giving him drugs and alcohol and having sex with him, and his 34 or 40-year-old manager started giving him drugs and alcohol and having sex with him. So three women sexually victimized him by the time he was 15. The fact is that you know, he was kind of bragging that he lost his virginity at 8. And a lot of guys do that same thing when they're actually victimized. The fact is, we should talk about it as it is. The truth of the matter is that when somebody who is significantly older targets a younger child to have sex with them, to initiate them or to take advantage of them, it's sexual victimization all the way up to rape. And it is a crime, and we have laws to protect these children because they can't make decisions on their own. They are so easily manipulated by somebody who's older in a position of authority over them. And that's why every teacher in every school should have an absolute rule that prevents them from taking advantage of touching a child in any way that's sexual, especially when they're under their care.
And that
custody.
Certainly shouldn't excuse what he did. So, you know, seeing that as a sympathy factor, they're actually risk factors in a sense at what you've just described. So I think absolutely you can understand somebody's sort of psychological and social development, but in terms of then going on to abuse other women, which he has a number of times, then, you know, yes. That in and of itself, of course, is absolutely not acceptable, but it does help us to understand right. where he has come from in his psychosocial and sexual development.
Right. Yeah, I absolutely, it doesn't excuse his behavior, but it is, we can look back from the outside and understand what happened, and then we can stop doing the things that help promote that kind of behavior. It's you know, you can't just say, oh, after the fact. I mean, you're very good, Laura, by the way. You have started a program in the UK to prevent violence against women. And that is like the first time that I know of in law enforcement where there's been an effort to prevent it from happening in the first place rather than just locking up people who commit crimes. So I think if we look at that as a very forward-thinking, positive way to prevent crime, to prevent victimization, then I think that we'll all be better as a society.
It kind of goes back to exactly what, you know, Mike opened with, which is about how we socialize children and, you know, what messages there are around to little girls and to little boys, what healthy relationships look like, and being able to talk about abuse or things that are happening to you and disclosing that. You know, and it all happens much earlier on in life. And what we see in terms of the homicides and mopping up the blood and all the damage that's done, you know, obviously when we profile it backwards and we reverse engineer it and understand the sort of psychological autopsy, it always comes back rooted to, you know, trauma and abuse in one manifestation or another, which absolutely doesn't excuse violence. And I certainly don't think violence and abuse is inevitable. It is absolutely preventable, but we've got to go right back to the roots of it.
He would get drunk and then for no reason whatsoever unzip his pants and make you look at his penis. Like in one instance, I recall in the kitchen, he'd to come here and pull me right over and he says, look, I have effing warts on my private, so she's cheating on me. And I'm in the middle of just doing homework and watching TV.
How old are you at this point?
So I would have been 13 or 14 at that stage.
And absolutely. I'd like to say, you know, to all of the people that reached out, that called in, that sent messages telling their stories, you're not alone. There's millions of people just like you out there. And I really encourage all of these people to reach out. And if we could mention those organizations once again,
absolutely.
You know, I'd like that to be out there.
Yeah, I wanted to mention another one in particular. It's called Darkness to Light, and it offers a 24-hour hotline for adult survivors of child sexual abuse, and it's 1-866-4-LIGHT, Forlight. I was just looking at the website. It's an amazing organization, and there's just it's such an appropriate metaphor, darkness to light, because that's what a lot of us feel like.
Yeah. And I'll be giving the opening keynote address at the Darkness to Light conference in Atlanta coming up in October.
Really?
So, it's open to the public, and it's a very, very comprehensive conference on all topics related to child sexual victimization. So you can look that up on darknesstolight.org.
I didn't know that. It was a coincidence that you're doing. That's great.
I do a lot of this kind of speaking. Mike, would you like to talk in a general way about some of the voicemails and texts and tweets that you've gotten as a result of episode 99 of Sword and Scale?
Yeah, and I also want to stress that we got calls and voicemails from both men and women telling their stories. Mm-hmm. A lot of them, you could hear the emotion in their voice. It was palpable. And a lot of them came out and said that this is the first time they've ever talked about this. Some couldn't even get their story out. They broke down halfway through and couldn't even finish the voicemail.
Right.
Aww.
So it's incredibly impactful emotionally. I mean, I had a tough time listening to all of them. I'll be honest. It's hard to listen to these things again and again. But, you know, I think that I did listen to every single one of them. And I think it's important that people understand that there's someone out there that is willing to listen, that is willing to help. These messages ranged from people who had accepted what had happened to them and were very matter-of-factly talking about it to, you know, people. I think one person said that they felt that their life was a complete black hole and every single day they wanted to die. And that's incredibly difficult to listen to.
Yeah, and I just would encourage that person to try to reach out. I mean, they took the very difficult first step of reaching out to us, Mike. And if they reach out to some of the organizations we've mentioned, MaleSurvivor.org, SafeForAthletes.org, StopItNow.org, DarknessToLight.org, all these organizations are here to help you, and there is help, and it is possible to feel better about your life. I'm a living example of that. So is Lisa. And we have been through things, and it doesn't mean that it's the end of our lives. And I think there are so many of us out there that you should feel strength in numbers. You should feel like you're not the only one, that it isn't your fault, that it isn't something that you did. It's simply that this person targeted you to commit a crime. You're the victim of a crime, period. You did not bring it on yourself. No matter what was going through your mind at the time, no matter how manipulated you were a child and not responsible for the actions of an adult who took advantage of you.
And everyone does deal with it differently. And I can certainly say from my own experience, you know, people do deal with it differently. Some talk about it. Some don't want to talk about it. Some write about it. I've certainly listened to some brilliant podcasts about it. Tara Brack in particular, who talks about trauma and when you've been abused and what trauma looks like and feels like. And I think that sometimes you have to go to lots of different sources to try and make sense of what's happened to you. It's not always about talking out about it immediately. So I think those websites and numbers, etc., are really important resources. But there are other things like the Tara Brack podcast, and where she does talk about trauma of abuse in particular, you know, particularly when people feel that overwhelming sense of hopelessness and confusion. You know, my advice, as well as hearing the things that you're not alone and, you know, that many others have suffered, is just having some practicing some daily self-compassion, which sounds easy to do. But actually, we can get stuck in a negative track and an echo chamber in our own heads about what has happened to us. So there are different mechanisms out there, and there's certainly lots of people and websites. So please do reach out. You are not alone.
I want to say one thing, which is, and I don't want to spend a lot of time or bring too much attention to this, because it's such a small, very, very small marginal percentage of what the overwhelmingly positive response we got was. But there are a few individuals out there who like to play web sleuth and think it's some sort of game and are quick to jump on social media and dismiss the allegations of abuse in some of the stories that we told. And if you're that person, you are the problem. You are clearly the reason why a lot of people don't speak out. To deny someone's allegation of abuse, you're despicable. And that's all I have to say about someone like that.
I was just about to say something just like that, Mike. I'm so glad you did. We are in a crisis. I mean, we know that there are millions of victims and survivors. And why aren't we moving into emergency prevention mode? I mean, if this was a disease that had millions of people suffering, just like, you know, this opioid crisis we're constantly, you know, we're hearing about, we would be moving mountains to stop it. And yet there will continue to be millions of victims until, what do we do?
Well, first thing we can do is we can stop supporting organizations that promote it. I mean, today I was reading an article about how the Catholic Church brought one of its, you know, ambassadors back to Rome to prevent them from being prosecuted here for child pornography offenses. I mean, that church in particular, because it has a country to protect it, because it has diplomatic immunity to protect it, has gotten away with it for hundreds of years, literally hundreds of years. And that is just despicable. And when are people within that church? I know people who have left the church, like myself, because they're disgusted with that. But when are people in the church going to make them responsible? I mean, hold them responsible. You can't say that somebody, just because somebody's a priest or just because somebody's a bishop or a pope, that they're infallible and that they can't do something wrong. They need to be treated like criminals if they are criminals, period. And until we do that across the board to every single offender, not just one or two, not just the ones that look bad, not just the ones that aren't in a high position, we have to deal with everybody equally when they take advantage of children. It's just, I am sick of reading these articles over and over and over again and seeing this happen over and over and over again.
Yeah, and you know, it's not just the Catholic Church.
No.
It happens in synagogues. It happens everywhere.
Yes.
But you have to step forward. You have to, if you see something, say something. If you feel it in your gut, say something.
Yes.
It's an epidemic. It's a crisis.
Children need to know that there's somebody out there fighting for them. When they're in the midst of this, when they're about to be victimized, when they're being groomed into a situation, all those things, if they know that somebody is there to help them, then they'll be more likely to reach out.
Sorry if I interrupted you, Mike or Laura. Go ahead.
No, I think that's absolutely right. You know, I'm disgusted by what the Catholic Church seems to have covered up, and when all of these stories broke, I was disgusted by sort of the reaction of some friends and family and colleagues that are, you know, Catholic, and we're really kind of defending this behavior to some extent.
Defending it, and sometimes the silence colludes with it too. And I certainly saw an article released again last week about the Catholic Church in particular. We obviously covered the keepers, but again, it was talking about how child victims, that they won't be able to access compensation because it's deemed that they consented. And that was in The Guardian just last week, which is just outrageous.
It is. It's outrageous. I mean, that they consented. It's to me, there is a fundamental issue here that needs to be eradicated completely. And that is that somebody, no matter what their position is, somebody who takes advantage of a child sexually is committing a crime, period. There is never responsibility on the part of the child. Never. And that's because they're not developmentally mature enough to make decisions about this, which is why the laws protect them. That's
a child
absolute,
can never
it's
consent.
Outrageous.
Exactly. A child will never be able to consent. And that's in our law as well. So I can't understand why it's deemed that they won't be allowed compensation.
Well, let me give you one reason why it might be that people in the church say that. Well, the ambassador, bishop, cardinal that I was just telling you about, he wrote his doctoral thesis on how the church should deal with these offender priests. And he was caught in a child pornography sting.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
You know, it's just so the people that are making the rules in that case are actually sexually attracted to children.
Just turns my stomach. Yeah. I mean, it's just that unconscionable. There has to be accountability here.
Yeah. Well, I know that I speak, as I was saying earlier, Lisa and Laura and Mike, that I speak around the country and around the world at different conferences. And there have been, you know, maybe 20 instances where I have actually told about my story. And every single time I do that, I'm approached by people in the audience. And many times that's people in law enforcement who came to me and said, I've never told anybody about it, but I was victimized too. And I joined the police department or whatever department to try to help kids too and prevent it from happening again. And I applaud those heroes. Unfortunately, most of them have to remain silent because there are also organizations that say we will not hire somebody if they were sexually victimized as a child. Mm-hmm. And that's just outrageous. It's the kind of backward thinking that was thrown at me when I was in the FBI, and it needs to stop as well. But I've also spoken probably 500 times just on the topic of child sexual victimization around the world, and almost every single time, just generically talking about the topics, I've had people come and disclose to me, and some of them are carrying tremendous pain, and some of them have made tremendous strides, and they're doing wonderful with it. But the fact is, there are many, many, many of us out there who have chosen a role in law enforcement or related professionals to help kids from having to go through this, to prevent kids from having to go through this. And that is a very laudable goal. If we want this to stop,
yep,
we have to focus on prevention,
yep,
not just locking up the bad guys. And one way to stop it is to speak about it the way you have helped us, Mike, speak about this. And again, I've thanked you a number of times in emails and texts and so forth. But directly to you, I want to thank you so much for giving me the opportunity not only to tell my story, but to be part of such a meaningful, powerful episode of Sword and Scale. Because just the responses that you've forwarded to me, they've been profoundly affecting me. And I wanted to reach out to every single one of these people,
yeah,
and tell them, look, you know, I'm here and you're not alone. But I do also want to respect their privacy. So I'm not going to reach out to them other than through this podcast. And I hope that you also post this podcast on your feed, because we want this topic to be discussed openly. The more openly it is discussed, the less this conspiracy of silence can exist, and we will actually help prevent children from being victimized this way.
Thank you, Jim. I can't express how thankful I am that you were part of this program. And everyone that did reach out, including the other two survivors that were on the program and were brave enough to tell their stories, I can't thank all of you enough for shedding light on this very difficult topic.
Well, thanks for making time for us, Mike. I know it took a long time for us to organize getting together, and we're so glad that we could have this crossover episode between our two sister podcasts that are both on Wondery. I just really appreciate you have such a powerful platform, and you just know that you have unburdened so many people that you'll never hear from, that will never write to you, but, you know, they're out there.
Yeah. Yeah. And thank you, Laura, too, for being the champion that you are for victims in the UK and around the world. I think that together we form a very formidable army against this kind of any kind of abuse, but in particular the abuse of people who are very helpless.
I agree. And, you know, there are many people who I know and we all know who do use these podcasts as therapy. And, you know, that's another, whether you're sat at home listening to this in your living room or whether you're in the car, I know this is helping so many people. And I want to signpost people as well to Male Survivor, the website, just in terms of the 10 daily affirmations that are on there by Dr. Howard Fradkin. I think they are fantastic affirmations that anybody who has experienced abuse, no matter what type of abuse it might be, whether it's stalking, whether it's domestic violence, whether it's sexual abuse, whether you're abused as a child or as an adult, I think the affirmations on there are things that you can take away and you can write in a journal, keep in a diary so that you can go back to them or put them on your iPhone. And then when you're ready to speak out, when you, you know, each day going back to those things, everyone's journey is very different. But we believe you. And that's what I would like to end on, the victim's voice again, us giving it airtime and a platform. And we believe you.
Yeah, that's a great hashtag. Hashtag we believe you.
That's right. Well, thank you very much for joining us. And we're signing out now on Real Crime Profile.
If you like our podcast, there are a few things that you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcast and leave us a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotion and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go over to Facebook and like our Facebook page. And one last thing is please tell all your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening to us. We really appreciate you.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107 or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter, or counseling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357, or go on their website, www.genesisshelter.org, or the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.